host EJ Fagan. Tonight, I am joined by BP Bronx's editor-in-chief, Stacey Gatsoulias.
Hello.
Hello, Stacey. And I am joined by Mr. Scott Moss.
Hey, Stacey and EJ.
So we wanted to have a chat, a talk today. We've been kind of been like low-key rumbling with us for a couple of weeks now. And this is not going to be a baseball-centric episode. We're going to be talking a little bit about the politics of baseball, about some specific things that have happened around the Yankees in the last couple of weeks. And we will not be talking about the two Gleyber Torres home runs that I have watched while getting ready for this episode. For that talk, tune in tomorrow night where we will be having our normal episode. But for today, I want to start talking a little bit about a story about the Yankees and Pride Day that I think is about 2 weeks old now. So, Stacey, can you explain that?
So, Major League Baseball has been holding Pride Nights for a few years now, not all the teams. And it's a little, I find it a little troubling that the Yankees don't do it, considering all of the gay history that's happened in New York City. And the Mets do it. And they just started doing it over the last couple of years. But I feel like the Yankees will probably never do it just because of who they're associated with and who owns their channel and, you know, all the people who are friendly with our current president. And it's just disappointing. I mean, I know the reasons why they're not doing it, but it just makes me really upset.
So let me push you on that. What are those reasons? Why do you think they aren't doing it? And to be fair, so we said what, all but seven teams do a Pride Night of some kind?
Right. 23 teams hold Pride Nights. And basically the whole NL, except for the Marlins, holds some sort of Pride Night. And the Cubs are doing two different nights. They're doing something in June, and then they're doing something in August also.
Before we get into the reasons, actually, what is a Pride Night?
Well, baseball teams have decided to recognize the LGBTQ community and hold nights commemorating Pride, because June is Pride Month, and the majority of the teams hold their Pride Nights during June. And, you know, considering how conservative baseball is overall, it's really great to see how many teams are participating in this. And even 10 of them now, they announced a couple days ago that 10 of the teams are going to be giving out Pride hats. So they're going to be like rainbow-themed baseball caps, and everyone in attendance is going to get them. And I think that's really cool.
So why are Pride Nights a good thing socially some Major League Baseball teams to do?
I think it's because they're showing that they're including everyone and they're not discriminating against anyone for their sexual orientation. You know, over the past how many years now, you know, gay marriage has been passed pretty much everywhere, and, you know, it's more accepted finally, and I think that's why teams are doing it.
I think it's a symbolic gesture is the way I think about this. Mm-hmm. And that you know, I was just looking at some videos of Pride Nights, and this is pretty low-key stuff, right? Throw out a couple of first pitches, give out a rainbow cap. This is not the Pride Day parade. You know, there's not going to be lots of shirtless men kind of, you know, beating drums and things. And you know, Pride Day parades can be a lot of fun. But, you know, we're not talking about something disruptive in any way. So, Scott, I want to just ask you, why do you think the Yankees are among the seven teams, despite being the most high-profile team in baseball, not to hold a Pride Night?
Yeah, I was surprised when you guys were talking about this that they don't, because I hadn't focused on this, but it is striking. Before I give some reasons why, I just want to, well, first agree with everything Stacey said, but also note how jarring it is not to, because when Pride Night was new, I don't know who the first team that had it was, if you do tell me, but I could see that being cutting edge. It was probably all the more important back then, but I wouldn't necessarily fault a team for not being the first one to think of it. But there's something about being the last team to do this that makes it especially problematic. right? Teams do this. You're at some point taking a stand not to. And teams that have their own political perspective, or owners, I should say, that have their own perspective, or regions that are not as liberal, still do this or started to do this. So the Rockies are owned by very politically conservative and evangelically Christian owners, and they have Faith Day, which I love the name Faith Day because on the one hand, it connotes that it's about all faiths, but then they name it that but don't even pretend, because the Rockies posting is, quote, "Besides being a great outreach opportunity, Faith Day offers Colorado churches and Christians from all over the state the chance to come together for a time of fellowship at the ballpark." So the Rockies have Faith Day. That annoyed me. But as of last year, they started doing Pride Day. So you know what? Like, I'm good with whatever you want to have. If you also have Pride Day and you have this and you have that, they have Star Wars Night as well. So people in Chewbacca costumes are there. So I feel like if you have your own perspective as a team, do what you want with it, have your own thing. But if you don't want to give the other side a fair shake, or people of other perspectives, backgrounds, demographics, then as someone you are excluding, a group that's felt excluded justifiably due to things like this. And as to why the Yankees are not as far along as the Rockies, who are, you know, the Yankees owners are sort of big money business conservatives, like Mitt Romney conservative types. I think that the Rockies owners are sort of standard Western, to some extent, Southern conservatives who, you know, more across the board social conservative. But, you know, they started doing Pride Night, and I give them some credit for that, you know, small round of applause or one cheer for that. But I think that's to say it's all the more galling that the Yankees don't. They're not even the most conservative team, certainly not the most conservative region out there, as Stacey's noting, yet they're the last holdout almost.
I just found out, because I looked it up, it is said that the Cubs may have been the first team to do it all the way back in 2001.
Oh.
Yeah.
And I mean, I also want to underscore, especially when you go back to 2001, how important something like this just symbolically is for LGBT kids. I mean, kids these days are better off than when we were kids, LGBT kids, but they're still bullied disproportionately. They still look to role models like sports, or kids in general look to role models like sports to show them how to act. And so, you know, the little gesture of, you know, Brett Gardner going out there and catching the first pitch from, you know, an LGBT activist, or just someone, or just a, you know, a leader of some organization, or just some kid, that matters. That really does make an impact. And this is, I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm outraged as if the world is going to end. There's some other stuff we're going to talk about today that I'm a little more outraged about, honestly, but. This is, I think, if it's a part of a pattern, it becomes a problem. And I think I want to underline what Scott said, that like, if we're at the point where not holding a Pride Night is a statement, and they the Yankees and the Marlins and a few other teams have, and the Rockies have made that statement. And it's certainly not coming from the fans. Like, Yankee fans are from New York. They are very accepting of LGBT people. They are, you know, the Mets hold a Pride Night. This is coming from the organization, not from the fans.
Well, I'll say, too, that as you were saying about this being more important back then, as of around 2001, I don't have the exact number because I remember it as of the late 90s, but in the vast majority of states, close to 2/3 of states, it was perfectly legal to fire or harass someone for being gay. So maybe there are folks listening saying, why do they need special treatment, special rights? Why don't we have a straight white male night for me? Well, the answer is that there are systematic exclusions in society that went on more in the past, less now, but they were actually entirely legal through most of the 2000s. We've only gotten to the point where a majority of states, but far from all states, make it illegal to discriminate or harass based on sexual orientation in education, employment, and other realms of life, not just marriage, which was legalized, and that's good and all, but if you're married, but you can still face employment discrimination. Literally, I'm not going to hire you, you are gay, is legal in a large number of states, and kids getting harassed in school for being gay is actually not, according to many courts' readings of law, a violation. So it is actually a meaningful statement, I think, still, to, but all the more so in 2001 or 2010 or whatever, to say we are being inclusive, you know, of people of all sexual orientations, genders, etc.
I found a statement from Jason Zillow from last year, because I guess the Yankees were actually called out for being one of the teams that do not hold a Pride Night.
Stacey, who is Jason Zilla?
Oh, yes. He's the team spokesman. He's the guy that you guys always see in the press conferences that he directs the press conferences, the little guy with the black hair. And you always see him on the field, too, directing the players towards either Susan Waldman or Meredith Marakovitz for post-game interviews. He explained that even though they've chosen to refrain from holding a gay pride event at the stadium, he says there's a lot of involvement behind the scenes, and he cited work that they've done with organizations that assist lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and gender youths. The pregame ceremony last year to acknowledge the nightclub shooting at in Orlando. And the statement that he said, everyone of every nationality, religion, ethnicity, or sexual orientation and or preference is welcome at Yankee Stadium every day. We are a long-term believer in diversity and inclusion and have always looked to create a safe and supportive environment for all fans to enjoy their experience here. So they kind of like...
Pride Night. That's the answer, right? Like, what's the excuse for not holding it?
Right.
I like also the answer that, you know, we're supportive, but don't ask us and we won't tell. And we want to be supportive, but only in a small enclosed room, kind of a closet, if you will. So, yeah, it's real classy.
Yeah. So, they basically were like, well, we do this, so we don't have to do this, which is kind of obnoxious. So,
I want to beat this to death. So I want to move on to the second kind of part of this pattern. And this is one that disturbs me a lot more. And I think I've tweeted about this from our Twitter account a few times. The Yankees have an unusually close relationship with notable conservatives. And I'm just going to list out a couple right here. Randy Levine, the Yankees president, considers himself a close personal friend of Donald Trump. The Steinbrenners have been mild Republican donors, nothing really huge, but, you know, have been frequent donors to the Republican Party over the years. The Yankees have a very prominent sponsorship with Fox Business. Including, I believe they still have that big sign out in right field, big Fox Business sign. Then the Yes Network is owned 80% by 21st Century Fox, Rupert Murdoch, who also owns Fox News. And last but not least, this is the one that annoys me the most. The Coke Industries is now advertising on the Yes Network. And they're not advertising a product. They're not even advertising one of their subsidiaries that sells products. They're advertising the holding company, which bothers me. So let me go to Stacey first. Among the things I just read, what bothers you the most?
I think the Coke Industries thing is really bad. Because they basically control every, right? Aren't they really like in charge of all the conservative stuff in the country? Like they're really, really influential. And that disturbs me.
The political scientist in me. Okay, so I have some professional obligation to say certain things right now. The Koch brothers are probably the largest political donors in the world. Mm. They spend hundreds of millions of dollars on elections alone every election cycle. They coordinate other billionaires to do similar things. So they're essentially they're the godfather billionaires of conservative libertarian-ish the political class. They also give a lot of money outside of politics to do. They donate a lot of money to things that just are perfectly fine. You know, art museums. They donate to PBS quite a lot. They're big sponsors of PBS's science and economics programs. They're pretty good. They donate to academia a lot, including full disclosure, a center at the University of Texas at Austin, which is in part sponsoring my dissertation. So I don't want to say that any Coke money is tainted, but I will say that I don't like the Yes Network advertising, hey, the Cokes aren't so bad,
right?
Which is all they're doing.
Right.
They can sell products. I'm fine with them selling products and I'm fine with them donating money to nonprofits, but like, I don't want the Yes Network like holding up their reputation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And let me add on the front that I actually wouldn't be bothered by their political affiliations, you know, alone, if it weren't so in your face. And, you know, they're entitled to have it be in your face, but I'm entitled to then think worse of a couple things. So I'm sure you all remember the comments by Lon Trost in early 2016, where he said that They were very upset about the premium tickets being resold. And he said, quite frankly, the fan who buys the premium seat for cheaper, quite frankly, the fan may be someone who has never sat in a premium location. So that's a frustration to our existing fan base. And I did sort of the transatlantic fake William F. Buckley accent there for a minute there, because that's the only way I can envision this. So you have them literally saying, we don't want poor people sitting in the seats with rich people who pay more for good seats. We actually are upset. We don't view it as, you know, bring yourself up by your bootstraps if you are a poor person who ends up in the vicinity of a rich person. And then the Yes Network, you know, has that kind of integration with advertisements for one side. And then just the broader issue that it's actually reasonably hard to see a game, and they're entitled to make money off it and say you have to pay for these fairly expensive subscriptions, but they can't have it both ways. They have to own it that when they say our political perspective is we want deregulation, we support rich people donating gazillions into politics, and we clearly support one political side, then I'm entitled to think it actually is resentment of people without money and exclusion of people and literally looking down on people without their money when they make it really hard to watch a game unless you pay for premium subscription. And then they throw a couple bucks here and there at, let's build a backstop in a park in the Bronx. Well, that's terrific, but how about let some of the kids in the Bronx watch a game on TV if you want them to be fans? But the answer is putting up the backstop in the Bronx is cheap. That's window dressing. It's a little like when Philip Morris ran ads about a food program they did, and it turns out they spent more on the ads than actually providing the food. So I'm entitled to think that this is sort of scheming to make sure that the poor have to sort of live outside the bubble in some post-apocalyptic future when I see all this.
Well, I always joked because I had season tickets from 1999 to 2013, and my season tickets were up in the upper deck. And at the old stadium, you didn't feel like you couldn't sit in the seats that were close to the field. In this stadium, I always joke that it's like the Titanic, and that, you know, like the people up in the third class people are in the upper deck, and God forbid you go anywhere near the rich people, near the first class people, because that's how they do it now. Like, they have lines painted behind the seats in the first level of the concourse, so you can't stand too close, because God forbid. It's crazy.
So I'd like to also just, I want to put in a little plug for how terrible that Fox Business sign is. Fox Business is a racist propaganda outlet that employs some of the worst people in the world, the B-list conservatives, pretends to be an imitation of CNBC, and is really just people like Lou Dobbs telling me that Latino people are terrible. And many of the fans sitting, you know, in Yankee Stadium, including most of the young fans who will be the future Yankee fans, and the young players who are currently playing for Major League Baseball, should not have to deal with that bullshit. If this was an anti-Semitic cable news channel, it would not be acceptable for that to be there. But they're an anti person of color channel, and the Yankees should know better. This is worse in my mind than the Koch Industries thing, because the Koch brothers think they're the good guys. Like, the Koch brothers honestly believe in what they do. Fox Business is a cynical ploy to exploit the racism of old white people. And it is unacceptable that the Yankees, one, take their money, but more importantly, advertise for them prominently in right field.
I've always wanted someone to hit that sign and break it with a mammoth home run.
In my dreams, there's, you know, like Aaron Judge finds his way there and just punches it and smashes it into tiny pieces or something like that. But that'll never happen. But he'd be like the Paul Bunyan of Yankee fans if he did something like that. Soylent Green is what I was thinking of and vaguely referring to it, which is that I think there's a view of the world that Soylent Green, the old awful Charlton Heston movie, was that is this post-apocalyptic future with overcrowding pollution and people are dying, homeless people fill the streets, almost everyone's unemployed, and the only food to eat is this wafer that it turns out, spoiler, is made out of people. It tastes horrible. But then the wealthy elites are eating fresh produce, beef, drinking whiskey every night, and then Charlton Heston blows the doors off the place, which is hilarious politically now. I think there's a view that they were parodying there, but that is sort of the view of, yes, we are rich because we deserve it. We deserve the good seats. And if you're poor, you shouldn't be in the good seats. If you wanted good seats, you should work harder and pull yourself up by your bootstraps and not be the sort of people of color we talk about on the Fox Network. And, You should just be like us. And I'll say also there's a question of why the Yankees don't do this. Because after all, if they actually just wanted to be inclusive of fans and honestly have more fans, they could just come up with other ways. They could have Fox diverted to just the Yes ads, and we don't like it, but it's not at the stadium, right? Which is where people can get in sometimes on cheap tickets. I think there's an arrogance to the Yankees of assuming that you'll be Yankee fans because screw you, you're Yankee fans no matter what, as shown by the fact that the three of us are still Yankee fans, right? And this alludes to, EJ, something you mentioned that's not political, but the Yankee Stadium, you point this out, experience as a stadium is sort of lazy and weak compared to other stadiums that have better food, better entertainment, stuff like that. I think there's an assumption that you'll just put up with it if you're a Yankee fan, that they have a degree of, in a way, monopoly power that most sports teams don't have. But I try to vote with my feet, so I try to see Yankee games. I live in Denver, folks. But literally, I end up in New York a couple times a year. I've seen one game in the new stadium that I wanted to. I went last year to see Yankee games in Oakland because I was in the Bay Area. I bought two tickets there to see the Yankees play Oakland. I'm going to Chicago this year to see the Yankees play the White Sox. I'm trying to vote with my feet a little bit and see fewer games where I'm paying for tickets.
So let me ask Stacy first. Generally, what kind of corporate social responsibility do you expect out of a team like the Yankees? And put it on a scale of, you know, from whatever big publicly traded company, Coca-Cola, to all the way to, I don't know, whatever a company is, like, you know, closest to a nonprofit but not a nonprofit, you know, the ultimately corporately responsible. Like, where on that scale should the Yankees or should baseball teams or sports teams generally be?
I don't know about that stuff. You know,
Well, what do you expect? What do you expect the Yankees to be?
I don't know.
So let me phrase that a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. The Yankees are owned by billionaires. Mm. They are a business that seeks to make a profit. And we all the time we see there are thousands of companies in the world that fit that description, but they're not. They are less overtly political than the Yankees are. Should we demand that the Yankees are less political, or should we just kind of point it out and, you know, and that's it? Like, is it their right to do so?
I mean, I guess it's their right to do so, but we don't have to like it. Right?
Right. Well, Scott's point about monopoly power, I think is where this is important, at least to me. Like, the Yankees, I do not expect the Yankees to be progressive, right? Like, my entire political ethos as a progressive involves, like, grabbing the money out of the hands of Hal Steinbrenner and, like, giving it to the people in the upper deck, right? Like, that's what I would like to do. And so, you know, of course they're not going to be progressive. Neither should the owners of Coca-Cola be progressive. The owners of Coca-Cola should be coldly apolitical. And that's what I expect of the Yankees. I think even this is even more so important when you realize the importance of politics to sports in the creation of baseball stadiums, in the monopoly, essentially the antitrust exemption that they've been given by Congress. I think that they have a responsibility to take those gifts given to them by the public and at least behave neutrally. And I think, you know, in this case, neutrally means having a pride day, right? As we said, not having a pride day is the statement at this point. But I also think it is, you know, generally avoiding controversy and not being sponsored by Fox Business and all these things.
Right.
Yeah. Let me add that corporate social responsibility is one of those loaded terms that can be kind of vague. So when a company invests in green technology that isn't profitable yet, is it a good deed? Is it investing in their own bottom line in the future? It's sort of a little of both. It's hard to figure out. So I can fault the Yankees for not doing a lot of things. First, kind of like a company investing in green technology, for the Yankees it'd be investing in letting lower income folks and kids see games for cheap, for free, some way. When I was in college, I went to a lot of Oakland A's games, and they had a deal where it was that Tuesday nights, I think it was, with a student ID, it was $10 for a ticket or $12, something insanely low like that. You can set aside certain tickets for that. And the Yankees do a little of that, but it's kind of weak tea when you consider how many tickets they have at how much in pricing. I get that to fund the Yankees, their payroll, their stadium, and they're entitled to make a profit, they can and it's fine to sell most of their tickets for what the market will bear, but you know, they could allocate, you know, 1,000 here and there, right, in each game, and they don't. I'll also fault them for some of the easy things they don't do. I mean, again, Pride Night is something that is basically costless. And if they want to do things that look and are jerky with respect to the bottom line and tightening axes and keeping poor people out of rich people's seats, then at least do some of the, you know, win the easy ones, as an old boss of mine used to say in litigation, right? There are things that are hard, and then there are things you can do almost costlessly. Win the easy ones. And I'll add that, you know, you bring up obviously a big question, EJ, are they entitled to do this? They're a business, and so what? I'll add one thing, though, which is that there's some businesses where I can fault them, and that they're also a steward of an aspect of national culture that I want to be around for my kids. And my kids are 9 and 12, 10 and 13. No, sorry, they just both had their birthday. They're 10 and 13, and very few of their friends are baseball fans. And I think that's the fault of a lot of this. It's pretty hard to watch many games. Tickets are really expensive, more than when I was a kid. So I think they're screwing baseball in the long run. And I think it's probably because any owner is probably middle-aged to elderly. And maybe sometimes it stays in the family, maybe not. But I think their time horizon is like 5 or 10 years, maybe 15. And they're doing things that are causing generational harm, and they just don't care.
So what? Why is basketball, for instance, different than baseball? So, I mean, basketball is a majority African-American sport at this point, I believe. And certainly the majority of American-born players. And they don't seem to have this problem. Baseball seems to have this problem. Football, it seems to me that there's the most conflict right now over these kinds of issues. But baseball, it seems to me, kind of just humming along without really politicizing it, right? Baseball has just accepted a conservative equilibrium, I think, in a way that basketball certainly hasn't, and football is, you know, actively contesting.
Yeah, I looked up some numbers on the demographics of sports. I've always had this hobby horse theory. The NFL has a much larger percentage of African-American players than baseball does, obviously. Baseball is down to, I believe, single-digit percent are African-American. And NFL fans, though, are two-thirds white. MLB fans are 83% white, so really white. NBA fans are plurality African-American. So NBA, it's a plurality African-American audience. But NFL and MLB are overwhelming majority white, but it's different. MLB fans are on average richer than the U.S. population. NFL fans are more Republican than the U.S. average. MLB is disproportionately popular in high-income areas, NFL in rural lower-income areas. And this is from one summary. Quote, baseball gets the most love among Easterners and postgrads. So basically, Major League Baseball is played by a much more conservative population than the NFL. The NFL is played by, you know, largest share African-Americans who are pretty liberal, we're seeing with the current controversies, but it's played for mostly rural conservative white folks. Baseball, in contrast, is played by mostly Southern white folks and culturally conservative Latinos from Caribbean or, you know, Latin America. But the fans are basically liberal white people from cities like us. So there's this dissonance in both sports, and it's coming to a head in the NFL in the past 2 years. And I kind of welcome it because this was lurking for a while. And, you know, below the surface is bad because nothing gets done. At least things are said, and Colin Kaepernick has paid the price, and that's awful. But at least we're talking. In baseball, it's so been kept below the surface. But they're plodding along as Rome's burning, I feel like. They're losing fans, and, you know, they just don't care.
So I also want to just move on really quickly to talk about women in the sport. Effectively Wild had a great episode with Christina Carl of ESPN about 3 or 4 days ago. By the way, Stacey got a great shout out by Christina in that episode, which I congratulate her on. So I think that that was very nice. But the bottom line was that the sport has been very slow to add women to positions that there's no excuse for women not to be in. So analyst positions, business positions, front office positions, where these days you're very rarely hiring anybody with a baseball background, right? For the most part, you're hiring nerds. And there are lots of nerdy women out there who love baseball and I think would be great in these jobs, and they are severely underrepresented. Stacey, are the Yankees a problem in this sense any more than normal major league teams, or is this just a baseball-wide problem?
I think it's a baseball-wide problem, but the Yankees are actually, when you think about it, you know, they hired Kim Ng to be assistant general manager way back in 98. Gene Afterman still works as that position right now. You do tend to notice women in the Yankees front office more than other places. So it's so strange how in some aspects they're pretty, like, I guess liberal in a way, and then in other aspects they're so conservative. It's just strange.
I also want to just also briefly talk about baseball media. So Stacey, you've been around the baseball media for a while now. Are things getting more diverse or staying the same?
I think they're getting more diverse. You know, the Rockies now have a play-by-play broadcaster who's a woman, and the fans have been very accepting of her because she worked as a sideline reporter first, and she worked her way into the booth. And I think, you know, Jessica Mendoza, you know, given a national platform on ESPN, is really great. You know, I mean, there's a ways to go. You know, you'll see women in sports, you know, writers, broadcasters, being attacked on Twitter, you know, from guys who want us to get back into the kitchen, which is the oldest insult in the world and really dumb. It's 2018. Stop with that.
guys, be creative in your sexism.
Yes,
sexism.
Be more creative in your misogynist behavior and sexism, please. But I think baseball is moving in the right direction. Just as Christina said, it's so slow. It's like at a glacial pace right now. Like, Kim Ng should have been a GM already. Right now she's the senior vice president for baseball operations with Major League Baseball, and she's the highest ranking Asian American female baseball executive.
Do you think that there will be a day in the relatively near future, we'll say I have children soon, my girlfriend and I have children soon, do you think that there is a chance that one of, if we have girls, that one of those girls is scouted by a major league team, just as they would scout a boy?
See, the problem is girls will play baseball up to a point and then they're forced to play softball. That's basically how it goes, because you'll see a lot of girls in Little League. I mean, my next door neighbor, who's 4 years older than me, so she's 48. So years ago, when she was 10, she was on the Little League team, and she was one of the best players. She made the All-Star team for the town and went up to the northern part of the county, played one of the better teams, and she pitched a game and shut them down. And, you know, before the game, of course, they were all like screaming about a girl being on the, and they were laughing because they didn't think anything good would, you know, they thought that they were going to beat her up, and she shut them down, and it was like, whoa. And I think it's so strange because, you know, there were other girls in Little League. My mom wouldn't let me play because I have a lazy eye, and she was afraid I was going to get hit in the head. So my dad coached Little League for a really long time, so I'd help him score and I'd be at the games and do all that stuff. So I was never able to play baseball, but I wanted to so badly. And I had friends who did. And then, you know, once they got to a certain point, like 13, 14, it was like, okay, you can't play anymore. You got to go into softball, because there weren't girls' baseball teams back then. It was just guys played baseball, girls played softball, and in some places it's still like that. So it's going to be hard, and I'm not sure if we'll see a woman in MLB in my lifetime, or if it does happen, it's going to be when I'm like 85.
So I mean, we talked about Pitch a lot, the TV show Pitch on this podcast about 2 years ago. Where, and for people who don't know, the show Pitch was a show about essentially the first female, or the fictional first female pitcher in the major leagues. And my reaction then and is still now that the show basically makes Ginny Baker, the main character, out to be essentially the biggest celebrity in baseball as soon as she gets promoted to the majors, like, right away. And so, Scott, I want to ask, why that, and that rang very true to me. Why are Major League Baseball teams not like jumping over themselves to find the real life Ginny Baker, who could, you know, become a replacement level Major League Baseball player.
Yeah, I'm not sure why. The best way I can sum up is this. They posited Ginny Baker, and I've thought, and the three of us talked about this, I'm not sure why any of the large number of excellent female athletes in various sports couldn't be Ronald Torres, right? Or Austin Romine or something, right? There's a role for people like that. So I don't know. It's bewildering to me. The short answer is I think it's going to happen. I will fault MLB a little bit because there are things they could do. I BS'd about this when we talked about pitch. I've had my pet theory that I did some armchair math. For a one-time expense of $20 million and about $4 million a year, they could run the Girls Academy of Baseball in the Dominican Republic. It would be a boarding school for 100 girls, and it would basically be academics as well as baseball. And what it would be doing is basically seeing if out of 100 girls who are athletic, they'd be getting good schooling too, which is better than maybe they would otherwise get. They'd be expected to stay till 18. And see if you can, you know, get a couple players out of it. I think they could do that. I will say this, though, is that in the United States, though, you could have little programs. But MLB, compared to basketball and football, there's so many layers between playing recreationally in baseball. I mean, you could be an athletic person who takes up football a little later, but I'm actually coaching my kids' little league team this year. You're really behind if you only start as of age 10 or so, and if you don't play every year. And the number of players with siblings who play is so substantial because they play every day. They play catch every day. I see the difference in my kid and others if they don't hit for a week or practice at that young age. I think that it's gotten better. I don't think it's going to get anywhere near parity, and Campbell won't debate how much of it's physical or whatever, but I think that if all we're asking for is one or a couple women to be in the minor leagues, let me just start with that, because once they're there, it's happenstance who makes it. You know, you're seeing women play college baseball. Under Title IX, as more, you know, accepted these days than in the 70s, say, if girls want to play high school baseball, you're totally right, Stacey, they divert to softball, and that's just annoying as hell. And there's a college player, Sarah Hudak, who is a lefty pitcher, who is pretty good, but she got diverted because she got a better softball scholarship. And that's frustrating, but I think that girls can play. There are some girls playing high school baseball, and you don't need that many. You just need some for the pipeline to yield one. And yeah, there's a big winnowing effect, but MLB can only do so much about little leagues and middle school teams, which are really competitive these days. I mean, you'd be shocked at how competitive the 8 to 10-year-old teams are in my area of Colorado, which does yield a good number of players. Chase Headley and Greg Bird are from the same town, not far from me. It's really competitive at a young age, so you really got to get in early. And you need, for a girl to be having a chance eventually, you would need her to be in an area where they're open-minded in her little league, and then in the competitive leagues, and then the middle school and high school team, and then the right college, and not get diverted to softball. You need a bunch of things to go right. But if you're asking when will it happen for one or two or three people to make it somewhere up the ladder, you know, we can't be that far from that, can we?
Stacey, what do you think?
I don't know. I really... Who was that girl that... there was that French girl.
Melissa Mayhew. I keep Googling her every now and then.
Yeah. What happened with her? Because
she's playing softball in college in Florida.
Okay.
Stacey, can you explain to me who she is?
Oh, she was mentioned as someone who could possibly be the first girl to make MLB, because she was she's a really good baseball player. And I couldn't remember her name.
And she's French?
Yeah. Yep.
Yes, this is the damnedest thing. But this is the thing. You only need one. Is France ever going to yield a lot of good baseball players? No, but all you need is one really athletic person. She was really good. She was basically Ronald Torres in a way. She's something like 5'8", but she had a really good arm for that size, a really smooth swing. So was she ever get 40 home runs? No, but she's apparently a really good fielder with just enough popped hit line drives.
Yeah, I would like to see her make it. That would be cool.
Here's the argument. And anybody who heard us like 2 years ago make this argument, this is my American Ninja Warrior argument. And so, you know, take it with a little bit of a grain of salt. American Ninja Warrior, my second favorite sport at this point, because it is, my girlfriend is now laughing in the background right now, because I just love watching it. It's an obstacle course show. But notably, men and women compete on the same course, on this obstacle course. And so the times for men and women are directly comparable. The performance is directly comparable. They don't give women a women's tee, none of that. It's the exact same performance. And I believe 2 years ago, the by far best female athlete on that show. Her name is Jessie Graff. Was, I believe, the 7th overall player in that tournament. And this is a purely physical sport, right? This is a very, very tough, very, very demanding, you know, a sport. And she was the 7th best in the game. And other women have been top 20, top 30. The Yankees Major League Baseball doesn't need the best player in the game to be a woman. They need the 290th best player in the game to be a woman. And that, I think, would solve all of these problems that we're talking about in terms of fans, right? Just imagine how big baseball would be if you had 5 women playing in a game, right? I don't know what the demographics of baseball are in terms of the gender makeup. I suspect it's heavily male dominated. And imagine if you could get 50% women, right? If you could keep all the male fans and you could just double the number of women who come to your games, baseball would survive forever.
Well, like you're saying, only needing a few. Why doesn't Major League Baseball have, for example, 100 scholarships, full scholarships for college for women who play varsity baseball? They could do that.
God, that'd be amazing.
That would cost $5 million a year, right? Think of the crappiest player in the majors who makes $5 million a year, right? And you'd be dividing it among all the teams. This is chump change, right? They spend
tax
more on
deductible, so.
Banner. Right, so that you could fund this, and then you would solve the problem of Sarah Hudak being diverted from being a crafty lefty pitcher, which is perfect for making the majors. And Melissa Mayhew, 16-year-old, is promising. She left because I believe there were better scholarships for women, or at least more opportunities for women. But heck, if you had these 100 scholarships, you'd have 100 women a year playing baseball, and they wouldn't get diverted, and all you need is a couple of them to make it.
You know, I think... Theo Epstein, I hope you're listening. I don't understand why Theo Epstein does not have a war room at the Cubs offices right now, which is just a board of all the top women, like 13-year-old athletes in the country. And he's going to send out scouts to every single one. And his mission is going to be to find just the first high A player, woman, right? And then hopefully maybe the high A player gets the double A, right. And maybe the next one gets the triple A, and maybe the next one gets to the major leagues. Because the rewards for that franchise are just going to be so huge. And it's something that the other sports can't match. I really don't think we're ever going to get a woman, you know, as a lineman in football. Right?
No.
Like the physical demands of some of these sports just require such outliers among normal human beings, right? Like, I'm 6'4". I would be murdered in 5 minutes on an NFL field, right? And, you know, because you're talking about, you know, the most optimized for size men, right? Same with basketball, right? Like you're probably not going to find somebody who can just physically do that. The baseball skills that are most important, many of the most important baseball skills, are not gender imbalanced. Like hand-eye coordination is not something that men have a huge advantage of over women. Vision is not something that men have a huge advantage of over women. Reaction time, etc. Like, those are things that Major League Baseball players could do, and regardless of male or female. And on top of all of that, the baseball has the knuckleball, which I still think is our secret weapon here.
Yeah.
And there's no reason that you know, a talented, you know, woman athlete couldn't throw a really great knuckleball and get major league hitters out.
Do you know Barre, the new faddish, you know, yoga/Pilates type thing?
No.
Yes.
Yeah, they opened every of these studios. And so it's almost entirely women doing it. It just came out of ballet. But it's this incredibly rigorous exercise routine. I've done it a number of times. My wife's really into it and I've gone, except that it, because it was made for by women, female ballet dancers, as sort of a like build up strength and rehab is how it started. It's by and initially for women. They're trying to broaden it out to men, but it assumes a level of flexibility that a lot of us don't have. There are advantages women have in flexibility. So I tell you right now, if you have 10 female pitchers and 10 male pitchers in the minors, I bet you the injury rate would be higher among the male pitchers. Because it's all flexibility, whether the tendon's going to rip at times. So, by the way, I got a name for this program that Theo Epstein should start. First of all, they need 100 scholarships. But then, if you just set up a webpage that tracks the progress of, and tracks the stats of women in college, has video interviews with them to make it fun for people to look at. Like, how much would we geek out on that? I Google Melissa Mayhew every 6 months and say, hey, what happened to her? It's like, where are they now? So the name of the program is Who's On First. It'd basically be like, who's the first women to get it? Who's, you know, going to be in baseball first? Maybe it's not great, but, you know, you could, if you set up that webpage with video interviews and stats and just lists and, you know, little up and down arrows, and you have people write articles and submit them and interviews and whatnot. You set it up so that as a scholarship recipient, you maybe have to, you know, accept some number of interviews and be by a high school journalist who's female or something like that. And I'm just spitballing this, but Theo Epstein could do better.
Or hold a national showcase, right? Like invite the top women high school baseball players or even softball players to Wrigley Field, right? Like these things are cheap and easy to do. And I don't understand why Major League Baseball isn't doing it. And I think it goes back to diversity. If Major League Baseball had an equitable share of women in analyst and scouting and front office positions, I suspect that some enterprising person would have come up with this idea. And they don't. And I think as long as you have the Derek Jeters of the world running baseball, you will not have that kind of out of the box thinking that would be incredibly beneficial to the sport.
Do you know that
Girl playing baseball would make such a difference, and it would bring so many more fans in, but also young girls watching will think, hey, I could play baseball too. And that would build everything up too. So just having that one female player breaking in would create like a wave, you know? So then there would be maybe more down the line, you know, years after.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to American Ninja Warrior real quick. So because I have to, and my girlfriend's laughing again at me. So there's an obstacle on American Ninja Warrior called the Warped Wall. And it's a fairly, these days it's a fairly easy obstacle. It used to be a little bit harder. But for the longest time, no woman ever got up the Warped Wall. And so they competed, and then they were knocked out of the tournament, and that was it. And then I think 3 or 4 years ago, one woman finally made it up the Warped Wall. And it was the biggest story in the history of the sport. And then that woman also completed, her name is Casey Catalizzaro, hashtag Mighty Casey.
Oh, I think I actually remember reading about her. Yeah,
she now is a WWE wrestler, and she makes it up, and then she makes it up the last obstacle on the next stage, and becomes just a massive sensation. And women saw that, the women athletes competing on the show and those that didn't compete on the show, and started training harder and harder. And it once they started getting their training up to the same level as men, the playing field leveled, and now you have lots of women on the show who are competitive with men. And lots of women on the show who are far, far better than the best woman was just a few years ago. And there are some physical limitations. So, for example, the 5'2", like, you know, school teacher who is incredibly ripped and in shape just can't do some of the obstacles as well as a 5'10" guy can. Fine, that makes sense. But, you know, you're going to be looking for outliers if you're looking for the first Major League Baseball player who's a woman. So maybe she's going to be 6'2" anyway. And maybe someone who's 5'2" is never going to be competitive in the sport of baseball, but there are plenty of women athletes out there that are that size. If I remember correctly, Jenny Finch was like, she was like 6'3", right? Like she was giant.
She's giant. Yes.
Yeah, she is. Yeah. She's still alive. Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah. And so like there are like, you may have to look for the outliers here, but again, the 290th best player in the world has to be a woman, and that's it. It doesn't. We're not looking for the next day, Roger.
Hey,
the
average Jose Altuve is like 5'2".
the average WNBA player is almost 6 feet. So it's not as though tall women are such an outlier that you're going to find so few in the country, right? Like, I don't know a ton of women who are 6 feet. I know more men who are 6 feet, but there's enough to populate a whole league, right? In some elite professional sport, the WNBA. But I'll say, and to bring it back to, you know, the relevance of this to Pride too. Again, just to repeat one of these stats, I had Major League Baseball, if you exclude NASCAR, is the whitest fan base of any sport compared to NFL, NBA.
Hockey? I'm a big hockey fan.
Gotta be, yeah. They must have been not including the big ones. But when MLB is 83% white, and also, get this, the fan base is 70% male, which is tied with the NBA as the most male-heavy fan base. More than football, that surprised me. So when your audience is almost entirely white male, you know, you're sort of defying all trends in both equity in society and, frankly, demographics of who's going to watch or not watch your sport in the future.
I mean, the upcoming generation, so the generation that has not yet turned 18, I believe is majority minority. And if it hasn't crossed 51%, it's pretty darn close. I mean, that's what's coming, and baseball as a sport needs to appeal to that. Now, I will say baseball – you know, hasn't been great at recruiting non-white players from the United States, but to their credit, you know, 20% of the league is Latino. And I think that the baseball has done a better job recently, you know, adjusting to that, even though we've still seen some growing pains. You know, I think most of the Latino players feel pretty welcome at this point in baseball.
But get this, I think due to the cost disparities of the Yankees being so elitist about who watches, who gets the seats. By the way, baseball fans are 83% white. NHL, yeah, 92%. Some more, but you know, baseball's in the ballpark of the NHL, which we always thought of as this super white sport. And get this, though, 9% of baseball fans are black, 9% are Hispanic. So that surprised me more than the percent of black fans because, you know, there's so many Latino players in baseball from all countries and from the U.S. who are of Latino descent a couple of generations down the line. But Latino Americans are not fans at the same rate as white fans. So that's a huge red flag, I think.
All right, so we've gone on for almost 50 minutes. So, Stacey, I'm going to give you the last word here. Is there anything else you want to get off your chest here?
I'm surprised about the Latino number of fans, considering, I mean, like Scott said, you have guys coming from Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Cuba, Venezuela, like all these different, Mexico, all these different places, and I'm surprised that it's that low.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is absolutely shocking. Yeah. And it's something to keep an eye on. But again, we've gone too long. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be back tomorrow with a real episode of this podcast talking just about baseball on the field and how amazing Gleyber Torres is. Thank you, guys, for joining us. Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been your Bronx Beat Podcast.